Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's start today with the future of driving, or perhaps it would be more accurate to give it another name, the future of being driven, or life after driving. That could be a slogan for this half hour. Imagine a world in the perhaps not too distant future where human car and truck drivers are the exception rather than the rule. What are all the ways in which our society will change when we leave the driving to driverless vehicles and we humans become mere riders? And how will that transition look from human drivers to driverless vehicles? Well, joining us today, Dan Reed, professor of computer science at the University of Iowa, has been doing some thinking about this. He's also a former vice president for research and economic development at the University of Iowa and former corporate vice president at Microsoft. And we welcome him to our Iowa City studio. Dan Reed, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Start off by giving us a broad vision of where we are now, where we're heading in terms of autonomous driving.
Well, I think one thing that's important to realize about technology changes in general is often in the near term, we overestimate change, but in the long term, we tend to underestimate it. So we think about these really grand, radical changes, and usually reality plays out a bit more slowly. If you look at where we are with respect to autonomous vehicles, driverless cars, it's in some sense an evolution. So anyone who's seen those commercials about cars that can back up and park, parallel park in places that no human would think they could fit into, or cruise control that can sense how close you are to other vehicles, those are sort of the beginnings of autonomous driving technology. And it will continue to evolve to a point we'll look up and say, wow, we never realized the revolution had occurred.
Here's a revolution that I got to thinking about. I was trying to find a parallel, or perhaps a parallel. You can tell me if it's a parallel. It was 10 years ago that the first iPhone was introduced in 2007. 10 years later, I looked it up this morning, something like 80% of Americans own a smartphone. Now, that's 10 years. That's a blink of an eye. And we are all completely, or nearly all of us, are completely dependent on our smartphones. They're one of the most valuable objects we have in our daily life. That's incredibly fast. Could we have such an acceleration into this new technology with driverless vehicles?
I think so. If you look at the history of technology adoption, and the smartphone is a great example, but think about other recent technology adoptions, things like flat screen TVs, digital television. If you look back at the history of those technology changes, one of the truisms is that the point of 80 or 90% penetration, the number of years that requires, has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And I would say one of the great social challenges that we face in general is the fact that big changes, if you think about our grandparents' generation, used to happen on a generational basis. Mm-hmm. And so society had time to adapt slowly. Now we're seeing these rapid revolutions, and we humans are not very good at internalizing that sort of rapid social change that technical change introduces. And this is likely to be another instance of that.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation as we talk about the transition to driverless vehicles and all the ways that our society will be changed by that. Perhaps you've had some questions about it lingering in your mind. Share them this half hour, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about the transition. What will be some of the challenges or characteristics of the transition that's before us?
Well, there are economic ones, there are social ones, there are legal ones. And I'll just cite an example perhaps of each of those. An example, legal ones, are things like insurance liability. And if you think about this transition, there will be a period where there will be a mix of driverless and human-driven vehicles. And during that period, the issue about how you adjudicate accidents and responsibility, because after all, in the driverless car issue, the algorithm is the one that's defining behavior. And mm-hmm. so you've got a human behavior and situational awareness versus sensors and algorithms. And so there are legal and economic issues around that for sure.
So when we have an accident or a crash or something like that, you have you might have a company at fault. A human driver gets in an accident, a crash with a driverless vehicle, and so it's the algorithm versus the human in court?
Exactly. And so if you think about what we all do, we all violate traffic laws all the time. And it's situational context. If the traffic's flowing faster than the speed limit, then you drive faster than the speed limit. If you're in a hurry, sometimes you cut corners. Autonomous vehicles will not normally do that. They are programmed to abide by the law. But one of the questions people are starting to debate is, for example, would you have insurance for an autonomous vehicle? Would that be part of the vehicle warranty? That has some pretty important financial implications for people as well.
Mm-hmm. We don't have an answer to that yet.
We don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you mentioned also social implications here. What do you see as the chief social aspects we'll be wrestling with?
Well, one that's sort of a rite of passage is this notion of getting a driver's license. We certify people as safe to drive on the road, and that has implications for both the young and the old. I think one of the opportunities is to think about what happens for the elderly who may now be confined to home, who may now have mobility in a way that they didn't think about before. And that's a profoundly positive opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I'm imagining a conversation in the future, a son saying to his a young man saying or a young woman saying to his or her friends, geez, you know, my dad's so old. He had to learn how to drive.
Exactly.
He was back when he was a kid, there were no vehicles that drove themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That rite of passage would be gone. But when you talk about the elderly, whether we don't want to drive or we're unable to drive, this is could be a real blessing. For instance, we go out for a drink with friends. No one has to not imbibe.
That's right. The designated driver would disappear. In fact, one would hope that the whole concept of drunken driving would become an obsolete concept. If you think about ultimately when we have large-scale penetration of driverless vehicles, this notion that you get in the car and drive inebriated simply goes away.
What are the chief negative effects you foresee in this new driving technology?
Well, there will be some jobless dislocation. If you think about the fraction of the economy that relies on drivers to deliver goods, whether it be long-haul truckers and the implications for those, delivery vehicles, any service that depends on transportation to deliver goods, more likely to see some economic dislocation because of elimination of jobs. There are potential other implications, open questions about whether autonomous vehicles will increase the number of cars produced or even decrease it. If you think about the latter, the ability to summon a vehicle, not rely on a driver, if you could reasonably expect to have a vehicle appear at your home or your office 5 or 10 minutes, would you own a car? Because the average time a typical vehicle is actually driven by its owner is an hour or less a day.
Mm-hmm. So we would have huge parking lots or bays, areas spread out around cities that would be sort of storage areas of these autonomous vehicles coming and going.
That's a possibility. And there's another thing to think about in that context, because as I alluded to earlier about autonomous parking and the ability of vehicles to park in spaces that most humans would be reluctant to do so, and I'm a lousy parallel parker, I should just get that out right there now. Autonomous vehicles can park much more densely than humans could park. And so some of this sprawl that we see in urban areas from large parking garages, mm-hmm. some of that land might be reclaimed. There'd be a lot more parking density. So yes, there could be satellite lots, but it's quite possible that those could be compressed in urban areas as well.
Are autonomous vehicles safer? Will they be safer than the average human driver?
Well, I'm a technology optimist, so let me qualify what I say with that prelude. I believe so. If you look at the thousands of deaths that happen on U.S. highways every year, there's a high probability that those numbers will decline substantially. And it's largely driven by, if you think about the frequency of accidents, excuse me, many of them happen near to home, but they happen because of inattention, sleepiness, drowsiness, as we discussed before, inebriation. All of those things that cause us to lose focus or attention, those disappear in this context.
Mentioned, you know, many people, at least initially, or perhaps you can tell me how long this would last, many people, I'm guessing, would find it terrifying to be driven around in a driverless vehicle, parallel parking, especially when your speeds go up, changing lanes, so weaving in and out safely. Would we get used to that easily?
Well, that's one of those rapid social changes, and it's not unique to driverless cars. The same questions can be asked about pilotless airplanes, because that technology in many ways is perhaps even more mature because of the constraints there. I think initially, yes, people will be afraid. But one of the things to realize as well is that most of the algorithms in autonomous vehicles, they drive much more conservatively than the typical human does. So, in fact, one of the social adaptations is seeing a vehicle that approaches an intersection more slowly is much slower to pull through the intersection because it's looking carefully for pedestrians, bicyclists, those other folks who might skirt the red light and rush through the intersection. So that's a place where that sort of social adaptation is not so much more that the autonomous vehicle is being more radical, but in fact it's being more conservative than a human might be. And I suspect that will take some time to adjust as well.
Right, and we get rid of the idea of road rage, which can be something that leads to accidents and pretty big accidents, as a matter of fact, too. So machines don't get angry at each other. They just sort of recalculate.
Well, you can be sure that if you make an angry gesture in an autonomous vehicle, it's not going to cut you off at the next intersection.
Okay. Let's try to go back to our phones. John is with us in Des Moines. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about whether you imagine people being able to use their cars to run errands for them. So, like, say I need to pick up my kid from a friend's house, I just send my car to go get the kid. I know IV has a thing where you can order groceries online and I'll bring them to your car. Or even imagine, like, car sharing where, say, I drive myself to work and then send the car home, and then then my spouse could take the car somewhere else and then she could send the car back to me. You imagine things like that where cars are going around by themselves with no people at all?
That's an absolutely great question and wonderful observation. Yes, I think you will see that happen. You can dispatch your vehicle on errands. Companies can dispatch delivery services. Obviously, companies like Amazon are looking carefully at autonomous delivery vehicles. But if you think about the other investments that companies like Uber and Lyft are making in autonomous vehicles, they're looking very much at the model you described, where the vehicle is a fleet service, can pick up people, can carpool, can be dispatched to locations absent a driver.
Mm-hmm. Do we expect thanks for that call, John, in Des Moines. Do we expect traffic generally to move faster or slower or about the same when we transition into autonomous vehicles?
Most of the experts believe that traffic will flow more smoothly than it does now. If any of us who've ever driven on the highway realize that cars tend to bunch up at times, and it's because of the variations in human behavior, and there's some really good scientific reasons for why that happens. One of the things that is exciting as a complementary technology to these driverless cars is the concept of vehicle-to-vehicle communication, which means that they can share information. So if you think now about driving in your car, if you're a diligent driver, you see around you and you can see ahead of you, but you can't see over the horizon. Mm-hmm. But a group of vehicles can, in fact, share that information. And that means, one, vehicles can follow much more closely. That has some implications for energy efficiency of vehicles as well, from wind resistance, platooning, and drafting. But yes, one is likely to see much more fluid flow, regular flow of vehicles in that context than we do now with human drivers. I should hasten to add, though, that as long as there is that mix of human and non-human vehicles, we'll still see some of those challenges. Most of those advantages will really start to happen once you cross a tipping point and there's a substantial number of driverless vehicles on the road. It won't happen early on.
Yeah. Do we know what? How will we know when we've reached that tipping point? Can that be defined in a closer way?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I will offer back to your earlier observation about the rapid adoption of cell phones. In the technology industry in general, people describe early adopters and then an early majority and a late majority. And the early majority in most contexts of adoption of new kinds of ideas is typically in the 20 to 30% range. So when you start to see a non-trivial percentage of vehicles on the road that are driverless, many of those things will start to happen.
Let's go back to the phones. Dan Reed, my guest, professor of computer science at the University of Iowa, talking about the soon-to-come transition to more and more autonomous vehicles on the road. I guess I have yet to see my first autonomous vehicle, just be surprised by it. Have you been out anywhere not expecting it, Dan, and seen an autonomous vehicle running?
I have in cities, and certainly if you go to the places where autonomous vehicles are being tested, places in California, Pittsburgh is a hotbed of autonomous vehicle testing, you will see those, and they're often given away by the array of sensors atop the vehicle. Of course, in production vehicles, those will be much more aesthetic and likely to be part of the design of the vehicle, but I've seen a few, yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our phones. Let's go to Troy in Iowa City. Hi, Troy.
Hi. I think my grandmother had a bigger technology change than we have. She went from riding a horse to riding in a jet.
Yeah. Well, those are a series of little revolutions there. A horse, you have electricity,
I think Iowa City is one of those things that they're going to be testing autonomous cars. I think the University of Iowa has a program out or something like that.
Yes, we've had Dan McGehee, the head of that program, right here on the program as well. Thanks, Troy, in Iowa City. But this is interesting when we talk about this last century or century and a half, you know, people have been through. But back to your earlier point, we have had new technology introduced on a generational basis. Now we're having to go through revolutions, several revolutions, so to speak, in a lifetime.
Right. And that has really important implications for society writ large, how we think about retraining of skills, because to go back to something I said earlier, if you think about the elimination of delivery and truck driving jobs, how do we provide and assure skills for those people so they can live a lifestyle that's appropriate? There are real sort of challenges from that rapid change.
I wonder, too, I'm thinking about a technology change when you and I, Dan, growing up, would have gone on family vacations. And also when learning to drive, there was no such things as Garmins or Google Maps or things like that. So you go along on a long trip across the country and maybe you endanger yourself and others by wrestling with the map and trying to open one of those hard to fold up maps. Maybe you have a navigator next to you. The sense that gave me of knowing where I am is quite different than simply following directions from a Garmin or Google Maps. That's a real difference, isn't it? Knowing where you are in space, not just where you start and where you end.
Oh, absolutely. And I certainly, as I suspect many of our listeners have, religiously follow the directions from my GPS only to arrive in an open field, realizing it was nowhere near where I really wanted to be. So, yes, you do lose some of those sense of spatial awareness because you're not thinking about where the intermediate paths are taking you. So, on the other hand, there's an old saying that one measure of any civilization is how many things you can do without thinking about it. And one of the advantages of automation, in fact, is that it has alleviated us of cognitive burdens to do certain things. Mm-hmm. And anytime there's a change, you run the risk of losing some things. You think about the fraction of people now who probably are no longer good at cursive writing or doing basic arithmetic because they reach for calculators. There's some good and bad things about those, but they're part of that whole notion of the integration of societal change and technology revolutions. But you're right. You will lose some sense of spatial orientation, no
mm-hmm.
doubt.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it a great thinker, perhaps Einstein, who said something like, never memorize something you can look up. You've got to free up your brain to mm-hmm. your mental capacity. Don't just do rote memory exercises, right?
Focus on the things that matter.
Traffic signs, traffic lights. Will autonomous driverless vehicles need any of those things?
No. But again, to my point about the transition, there will be a long period of years where there will be human-driven vehicles on the road as well. And so I don't expect to see any of the Department of Transportation hustling out to remove traffic lights anytime soon. But ultimately, yes, the way that those vehicles are situationally aware, they use LIDAR, so light imaging in the non-visible band, so to be able to detect objects, cameras, a variety of other shared information from vehicle to vehicle. And so they're aware in ways that don't rely on signs. I would say one thing to think about, painting highway traffic lines on the roads, that is an important element of current technology, and right. that will be important.
I've been out a number of times with Dan McGehee from the National Driving Simulator with a semi-autonomous vehicle. They do pay attention to those lines, and one of the points he brought up is, especially when we have snow and ice, you get those lines covered up, and then the vehicle gets to some degree blinded, or you have to keep it free of ice and snow because those lines are its guidance, right?
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Other traffic signs and lights, those will be there. As long as humans are out there, we'll have the signs and lights for a while.
And for sure. And remember that driverless vehicles will not replace pedestrians or bicycles. So in that sense, there will always be a need for directional signs and some way to adjudicate intersections.
Okay. We'll come back for a little bit more time with Dan Reed of the University of Iowa, professor of computer science, sort of imagining the future of autonomous vehicles. That's before us. If you have a question, we'll hopefully be able to fit it in. 1-866-780-9100. After I finish up with Dan here, we'll learn about the new head of Iowa's $5 billion Medicaid program, Michael Randall, and how he managed when he was in charge of Kansas's transition to privatized Medicaid. I'll talk with Andy Marceau. He's a healthcare reporter for the Kansas City Star. That's when we come back with more talk about driverless vehicles. Who's in your driver's seat? Who will be there in the future? I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're imagining a world in the perhaps not too distant future where human car and truck drivers are the exception rather than the rule, talking about the ways our society will change when we leave the driving to, well, autonomous vehicles, driverless vehicles. And we humans get to just be along for the ride in various ways. Dan Reed is with us, professor of computer science at the University of Iowa. Before we hopefully go back to our phones, tell me about how this you think will impact the car's design. Will our cars look much different when they're autonomous?
Well, if you think about one of the things that's really a hallmark of a vehicle is you need to be able to see, because that is the way you navigate and ensure safety. And the seat layout is designed to minimize distractions. The driver and a co-pilot, perhaps a friend, and if you're in a family vehicle, then the kids in the back. And that seems like a message handed down from above. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can imagine a world where if you don't need to look out the windows, and in fact you don't need a steering wheel or pedals, then a vehicle could become a mobile conference room. You could have a meeting. It could be a mobile kitchen where you gather with friends and travel to your destination. All kinds of things start to become possible when you don't have to look out the windows and control the vehicle.
Okay, so I've got an hour-long drive ahead of me with three of my friends. I order a vehicle. It's not my vehicle. From something, a vehicle/restaurant company. This vehicle pulls up in my driveway. It's picked up my other friends, and then we're off to a concert. And in the meantime, the company has looked after in a compartment. We have a dinner or something to munch on and drink.
Absolutely. You sit around the table, have some food, maybe play some cards, talk to your friends, and enjoy the ride.
Something as antiquated as cards, maybe.
Perhaps.
All right. Let's go to Ben in North Liberty, hoping our phones are working. Ben, are you there?
I am.
Excellent. Yeah. What's on your mind?
I just maybe address the ethical questions regarding, for instance, the programming of the algorithm. In a case where an autonomous vehicle might find it unavoidable to have an accident of one type or another and have to make a decision regarding a type of person that it's going to have to hit, will those decisions be made at a government level by each corporation separately? Will they be uniform? What can we expect with that?
Ooh, interesting question. Ben, thanks, in North Liberty.
It is a wonderful question, and it gets to the crux of what is perhaps a more important issue about adoption of driverless vehicles than the technology, which is advancing rapidly, is how you make those choices. It is a social consensus, and you're right, just as human drivers sometimes find themselves in a catch-22 situation where all of the choices are bad, sometimes perhaps of their own bad choices, but often of circumstances entirely beyond their control, we have to make split-second decisions, and it's based on a lifetime of ethics and training and socialization. This is a place where I think it's profoundly important that society be involved in the conversation, because shaping what those rules are, as you rightly observe, those are algorithms that are in the software, in the vehicle. And there is a very hot topic going on nationally about that, and it's called ethical AI, ethical artificial intelligence. How do you embed human ethics in the decision processes for those vehicles?
From Ben in North Liberty, let's go quickly to Katie in Iowa City. Not much time, Katie. Please, what's on your mind?
So I'm curious if you've got people who are against driverless cars for monetary concerns. I'm thinking like bar associations or law enforcement whose budgets depend on traffic tickets.
Yeah. Who's given pushback, if any, Dan?
Question, Katie. It is a great question, and it touches on exactly the issue that any technology change creates some jobs and it eliminates some jobs. That's sort of the nature of technical and social change. And yes, there will be debates and some pushback. We can see that in other domains. Think about the controversies over changes to healthcare as a salutary example of there will be big debates in this space.
Mm-hmm. To finish up here, talk a little bit about what happens when we have all this information. If I am tracked, I have to be tracked. The car has to take me to from point A to point B. There's a lot of data involved in getting me there. But where's all this data going? How will it be used?
Well, that's another one of those great social questions. But it pits, if you will, Silicon Valley and Detroit in a battle royal against one another about ownership. Because in some sense, the vehicle is the necessary evil to capture the data. And the true economic value will increasingly lie in the data, not the selling of the big hunk of metal that you drive down the road. So analyzing that data and determining how to improve the software in the vehicle, or as we've come to expect in lots of domains, how to do targeted marketing to you based on where you go, the things you might buy, the vehicle will learn an enormous amount about you. And those questions of privacy and sharing are deep and profound.
Mm-hmm. So no such thing as driving off unbeknownst to other people in the future, it sounds like, almost.
Probably not. Everyone will be watching, including your neighbor's car.
Okay, very good. Been very interesting. Dan, perhaps we can have you back once this progresses. We'll see when we do reach that tipping point, when everybody says, hey, I think I'm going to go in for a driverless vehicle. What model do you like? We'll be back with that, perhaps with Dan Reed in the future, professor of computer science at the University of Iowa, the UI's former vice president for research and economic development. Dan, it's been a real pleasure having you in the studio. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, Iowa has a new Medicaid director. Last week, the Iowa Department of Human Services announced Michael Randall will lead its $5 billion Medicaid program. Randall is the former leader of the program in Kansas, which also has implemented private management of Medicaid, a little ahead of Iowa. Kansas made their transition to privatized Medicaid in 2013, and Michael Randall was the administrator in charge. Joining us now, Andy Marceau, healthcare reporter for the Kansas City Star, to tell us a little bit about what Kansas experienced with Medicaid under Michael Randall. Andy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, before we get to Michael Randall specifically, tell us the story of the transition to privatized management in Kansas of Medicaid. Start off, when was it seen as a good move and why?
So Sam Brownback, conservative Republican senator, was elected governor in 2010, took over in 2011, and he had this kind of broad slate of conservative reforms that he wanted to implement. And one of them was, turning over Kansas Medicaid administration to privatized insurance companies, essentially. And now parts of Medicaid had been privatized already, but his idea was to essentially go all the way with privatization. And the idea was that because of private sector, efficiencies and dynamism, contracting out Medicaid would be able to save the state money. And without cutting rates to providers, without cutting eligibility, without cutting services, that the private insurance companies would realize the savings through care coordination, through getting people the right care at the right time and the right dosage, I guess you could say, to do things like prevent unnecessary ER visits and such. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of how it started. And the major kind of sticking point from the beginning was including in this privatization disability support services. I mean, like I said, other parts of Medicaid had been already privatized, and these three insurance companies had a lot of experience in running health and medical care plans. But disability advocates argued pretty consistently that they were not experienced in handling these disability support services, which is, everything from replacing catheters to, cooking meals and for people who can't do it for themselves so that they can stay in their homes rather than live in institutions. Mm-hmm. And the argument there was that you can't really cut the cost of those services without cutting the services themselves, that there's no sort of preventative measures you can take to keep somebody who's quadriplegic from needing that kind of help.
So with those arguments, was this group, the disability support services, treated differently when that was rolled out?
Yeah, so initially, for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in particular, because of those complaints, those services were carved out of the initial privatization for 1 year, so that the state could run some pilot projects with them and kind of try and quell some of these concerns. The concerns remained after that 1 year, but nonetheless, those services were then folded in to the rest of what we call CanCare starting in 2014.
Mm-hmm. So talk about the rollout as such. It was rolled out in 2012. The networks were set up in 2012, I believe, and then in Kansas it went live in 2013. What happened in those first months that you remember and reported on?
Well, one thing that happened almost immediately is that providers of services, whether be they medical providers like hospitals or disability service providers. Immediately we're complaining about sort of increased bureaucracy, increased problems getting claims approved and approved in a timely manner. And some of that is just logical. I mean, you went from having one payer, which is the state, with one system, to having three different payers, because when we contracted it out, we used three separate insurance companies. So then you have three different payers with three different systems of billing, and it was a lot for some of these healthcare providers to adjust to. And the state, you know, I think tried a lot of what I would call ad hoc fixes. They would get complaints from a specific provider, and they would address that specific provider's issues or get the insurance companies to address that specific provider's issues. But the systemic billing issues weren't really addressed in a systemic way until last year, when the legislature got a bunch of new members who were, I would say, a bit more interested in kind of providing more oversight of the three CanCare companies. And so we've had some things done in the past year to try and streamline some of those processes for the medical providers. But yeah, the initial rollout billing problems were pretty systemic.
Mm-hmm. So now, I guess more than 4 years after the rollout of Kansas's privatization of the management of Medicaid, how satisfied are Kansans who are served by Medicaid with this new management?
Well, I mean, I think what you have to understand is that Medicaid is a huge, sprawling program that covers a lot of different populations. You're talking about low-income children, pregnant women, people with disabilities, and then some parents of kids who are also on Medicaid. And, I mean, I think in general, you know, out of that group of 400,000, you don't hear a ton of complaints from clients who are served on the medical side, like the pregnant women, the children. You do still hear a good deal of complaints from the disability community, again, surrounding those disability support services, which they need to stay in their homes. I think that remains kind of a sticking point in the whole operation.
Mm-hmm. What does it look like from the companies that manage Medicaid in Kansas, from their perspective? Are they profitable? Did any of them drop out or come close to dropping out?
Nobody's dropped out. They lost a bunch of money the first couple years. Then they started turning the corner year three, and then last year was fairly good for them. So, and from what I was told and what, you know, everybody else was told, that's pretty standard, that these companies more or less expect to lose money the first couple of years. It's a new population that they're serving. They don't really know. They don't, you know, have their networks quite, you know, how they would like them. So it's an adjustment, and they expect to lose money the first couple of years and then make it up on the back end. I think all three have been profitable, some more than others. I don't know that anybody's planning on getting out. And in fact, at meetings recently, the state said they expect as many as 7 or 8 companies to bid on the next CanCare contract. So there does seem to be some, I guess, interest from the insurance industry in being part of this program.
How do those original reasons for moving to privatized management of Medicaid look now, more than four years in? The named efficiency, I think you said dynamism, and saving money. Have those been borne out?
I think we've certainly saved money over what we would have spent in Medicaid had we stayed with the old system. I think that's pretty well accepted broadly. Where the controversy lies in how the money was saved. The state would say the money has been saved in the way it was promised, through care coordination, through reduced ER visits and increased primary care and all that. There was a report put out on behalf of the Hospital Association and some other groups by an independent consulting group called the Levitt Partners out of Utah that said, yes, CanCare has saved money, but it has saved money just by squeezing providers, not necessarily by providing better care for people. Mm-hmm. So it kind of depends on who you ask.
Okay, so let's talk specifically about Michael Randall. As I mentioned at the outset, he is Iowa's new Medicaid director. He was the leader of the program in Kansas that went through the transition that you've been talking about. What is Michael Randall's reputation in Kansas?
Well, first, he generally goes by Mike, so
okay,
you'll hear him mostly called Mike Randall.
Good tip. Thank you.
So Mike Randall's reputation, I would say, is that he's a very smart guy. You know, Medicaid programs are extremely complex, and to, you know, exert any sort of control over a Medicaid program, you got to know a lot. He's probably not been as transparent and forthcoming as some groups would like him to be about what's going on in his agency. And he was also kind of put in some difficult situations, and this is kind of where the transparency comes in, is I think in some of these situations he could have, you know, been more forthcoming about what was happening. Like, for instance, about a year after CanCare went live, there were these sort of bureaucratic shuffling of agency duties, and all of the Kansas Medicaid applications were funneled into Mike Randall's agency, while at the same time the state rolled out a new computer program for processing all of those applications. And the combination of those two things at the same time proved to be kind of disastrous, and people weren't getting their applications processed timely. In fact, you know, the federal government had to get involved because the feds have a rule that Medicaid applications, most of Medicaid applications anyway, need to be processed within 45 days. And Kansas had applications that were taking 9, 10, 11 months, some cases over a year.
Hmm.
So that was bad. There was a backlog at one point of, you know, 8,000, I think, applications that were past that 45-day deadline. And so Mike Randall took a lot of heat for that. That was, again, those were decisions that were made, you know, above his level. But I would say that there were people who would have liked him to be a little more forthcoming about the difficulties that were happening.
Mm-hmm.
During the, as you may know, Kansas has had a number of state budget crises in the last few years. And during that time, in order to balance the budget, the state had to cut the Medicaid provider rates by about 4% for most providers. And that was, you know, on the heels of this promise that we were going to not cut provider rates under CanCare. So that caused a lot of angst for the providers who were already frustrated with some of these billing issues. And especially, you know, certain providers like dentists, there were a lot of dentists who were threatening to get out of Medicaid entirely, a few of whom did, some of whom just dropped one or two of the companies. And so, again, that was a situation where a decision was made above Mike Randall's level, but he probably, you know, there would be some people who say he did not handle the rollout of that decision as well as they would have hoped.
Does Mike Randall in Kansas, does he have a reputation for standing up for those who receive Medicaid services, the disabled, those who don't think that they've been well served?
I mean, I think his reputation was just kind of like a just the facts, ma'am type. I mean, I don't think he was necessarily interested in taking an advocacy position either way.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was just interested in saying as, you know, as little as possible.
So, Andy, thank you for all these insights. Last question here. If you were in, and this is just speculation, but an educated guess on your part, perhaps, with Mike Randall coming to Iowa, what would you guess would be his lessons learned moving into Iowa to do essentially the same thing that he did for CanCare in Kansas?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can't get in his head. That's kind of part of his reputation also. He's a little bit inscrutable. It's hard to,
okay.
I think it's hard to tell what he's thinking, and it's, you know, he's, like I said, not always super forthcoming about what he's thinking. He doesn't like to offer a whole lot of opinions. He's, like I said, kind of a just the facts, ma'am, type of administrator. So,
Sergeant Joe Friday type of administrator, for those who remember that show.
Right.
All right, Andy Marceau, healthcare reporter for the Kansas City Star. Thank you very much for this conversation.
All right, no problem. Thank you.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. Make sure you tune in tomorrow for a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Of course, lots to talk about in Washington. Also, the sexual harassment controversy, scandal seems to be everywhere. It's also in Iowa. We'll talk about that as well. Our guest tomorrow, Hans Hassel of Cornell College and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Politics Wednesday tomorrow. We hope you'll join us talking about the latest in politics. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton with Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.